I can't tell you what a wonderful privilege and honor, really, to be here passing on the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, and by passing on the meaning of his teachings, passing on the meaning of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. I want to begin with talking a little bit about Suzuki Roshi and how Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind came to be. Beginner's Mind, it's a term that gets kicked around a lot, and as if people think, well, everybody knows what that is. But I wonder, actually, if everybody knows what that is. And I think maybe the way to begin is to pause for a moment and ask yourself, give you a chance to ask yourself, what do you think beginner's mind means? We'll just take a minute for you to question yourself and kind of just take a stab at what you actually think beginner's mind means. And then it'll be fun to see at the end if what you think beginner's mind means stacks up with what you think beginner's mind means at the end of today. And it's not a very long session, so it'll be interesting. Just to say a little about how Suzuki Roshi came to be connected with this book, which he says, when he first saw it, he says, oh, that's nice. You know, I didn't write it, but it looks good. And he it's true, he didn't write it. He gave Dharma talks at satellite places around the Soto Zen Buddhist temple in Japantown, where he was invited to be a priest. And he lived there alone. Actually, it's a huge place, but they kind of gave him this room. And he started sitting Zazen in the morning and evening, and the San Francisco art community kind of caught on to someone doing Zen and started sitting with him. And then the satellite communities sprang up, and one of them, the host of the one in Los Altos, asked if she could tape record his talks. And so with his permission, she tape recorded them. They got transcribed and heavily edited and made into a book. So he just gave the talks, but the book was kind of created around him. And it's become enormously popular. But then I often wonder, people have it on their shelves, but they don't often read the entire book. And that, I think, is because it's not that easy. The concept of beginner's mind is sort of intriguing, but the real truth is, it goes against all of the values, I would almost say all of the values of the American population. And this is really ironic because Suzuki Roshi just loved Americans. He loved teaching Zen to Americans because, he said, Americans don't know anything. They don't know anything about Zen, and so they're open to, like, anything he says. They're open to receiving the teachings, whereas in Japan, everyone, you know, the Zen masters and practitioners in Japan were totally stale in Suzuki Roshi's opinion. They thought they knew everything. They were zipped up tight, and there was no freshness there. So when he came to America, he just loved the way Americans were so open to his teaching. But ironically, Americans are full of gaining mind, and the gaining mind is antithetical to beginner's mind. Because beginner's mind, which is, this is what this talk is about today, beginner's mind comes from the sense of Buddha nature, which has nothing to add. There's nothing to add to our original Buddha nature, which all of us have, all sentient beings and non-sentient beings have Buddha nature. Even rocks, mountains, rivers, the earth, everything has Buddha nature. And so there's nothing that can be added to that. So there is nothing to gain. And the gaining idea is so prevalent in America that if you ask some people, if you ask them to do Zazen, they say, you know, I don't have 15 minutes to not accomplish something. So, sorry, I don't even have 15 minutes to not be accomplishing something, so I can't. And that's, I don't know whether Suzuki Roshi really understood that about the American population. I'm just not sure. One of Suzuki Roshi's disciples, Reb Anderson, who's a Roshi today, talks about the way Roshi thought about the triple treasure, the triple Buddhist treasure, the Dharma, the teachings, the Sangha, and the Dharma, the Sangha. And the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And for the Roshi felt that the most pure and direct way of sustaining the Buddha treasure was to be fully himself in each moment. And the way to fully uphold the Dharma treasure was to practice wholeheartedly with no gaining idea. And the way to uphold the Sangha treasure was to do group practice in a community together with others. And that when you consider that Roshi felt that beginner's mind was really going back to our fundamental Buddha nature, it changes a little bit how we might be thinking about what beginner's mind means. Roshi says, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the experts, there are few. And this phrase has a kind of innocence around it and a lack of calculation and gaining idea. And another thing, this is a quote from Roshi, he says, at first the effort you make is quite rough and impure, but by the power of practice, the effort will become pure and purer. And when your effort becomes pure, your body and mind become pure, and this is the way we practice in. And I want to give you an example. So when I was 75, my husband gave me a banjo for Christmas. And I've always wanted to play the banjo, but by the time I was 75, there were many obstacles, as you might imagine. But I thought, well, I've always wanted to play the banjo, and so if I just play the banjo every single day, I'll be doing my best, and then I can't do better than that. So I'll have the joy of the banjo every single day. And before I started playing the banjo, I never could imagine that I, Gail, would be able to play the banjo. But actually, by just doing what I set out to do, which was like practice a half an hour a day, I can play a few tunes. And it doesn't seem special. It's just me playing my little tune, you know, working on it day after day. And if I let all the problems get annoying, as they easily could be, I could stop. But my attitude is just promise yourself to attend to your banjo practice time with an alert mind and knowing what you intend to do during that time and following the guidance of my marvelous teacher. Then I will make as much progress as I possibly can. And that's that. So it's kind of not about playing the banjo, frankly. It's more about attending to the banjo practice. But beginning at 75 actually has a lot of advantages. That because I'm not thinking, boy, if I work really hard, maybe I can win a competition. Or, too bad I can't play really fast like her. I just, you know, tick along and something happens. And, you know, I actually can play a few tunes. And they don't sound all that bad. And deep inside, I'm very satisfied. So in a way, it's easier to have a beginner's mind at 75 than it is at 15, because at 15, there are many notions and fantasies and, oh, I could be this and I could be that. And you're just striving to find out, like, who are you anyway? But at 75, you sort of know who you are. And there's not this idea of I can be this and that, and you're just very happy to do what you do, and there it is. So it's interesting that in the correct mind, there's really nothing to know. And it's important to understand that the difference between information, which is knowledge, and wisdom, which is not knowing. There's no way the human mind can know the enlightened mind. It's the enlightened mind is what is ungraspable by the human mind. And so in the end, it isn't even actually you or me playing the banjo, it's wisdom mind, and it's the source that plays the banjo, and I just have to keep returning to the practice of the source. Here's here's another quote from Roshi. Our original mind includes everything within itself. It is always rich and sufficient in itself. And he means that we have everything we need to begin and continue with our practice. And the goal of practice, he says, is always to show up and keep a beginner's mind. And it means that we stay endlessly fresh with that effort, because boredom, which is laziness of mind, is always remediable. So I wonder if there are questions. I have, actually, I have two questions that have already come in, and I think I'll answer those since the person asked them early, and then please ask me anything that occurs to you based on what I've already said, or not even. So one person asked, could you go into more detail about what Suzuki Roshi means when he says time and space are one? And what I want to say is that this is important. This is a great question, actually. And in Buddhism, there is this idea of the two truths. And the two truths are conventional truth, which is our ordinary understanding of things, and what can be grasped with the mind, and ultimate truth, which is beyond being grasped by the mind. And both of them are true simultaneously. Roshi used to say, if it's not a paradox, it's probably not true. So he holds them both. He often would, because of that, he would often say things that seemed baffling, probably to keep his students on their toes so they didn't get complacent and think they knew what Zen was. And there was one time when, and he also deliberately contradicted himself. So a student came to him once and said, well, you know, I heard you say such and such, and he interrupted her and he said, when I say that, it's true, and when you say it, it's not true. And you might notice that even today, when in our talk of related to the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, we're talking about beginner's mind, which is conventional truth, which comes from a place that is understandable with our mind. We're not talking about Zen mind, which is actually beyond understanding with our mind. So it's a little, I don't know, you can call it baffling or charming or I'm not sure what, but you see all these things, these brands of, you know, Zen, we have Zen nail polish today, we have Zen motorcycles. And I'm not sure what's in, I think it's just like, you know, it's used in this sense of quirky, but Zen is anything but quirky, actually. So I hope that helps. It doesn't answer the question exactly, but it says why Roshi would say things like that. And then the other question also is about, could you talk more about Zazen sitting position and how important it is or not to sit cross-legged? Sometimes Suzuki Roshi seems to say that sitting in the lotus position is crucial, but at other times he says, even if you have pain when you sit, you should just sit anyway. Use a cushion or chair, just sit. And the questioner says, this sounds to me like it's okay to sit upright in a chair when practicing Zazen. Is this correct? So even though it takes your whole body to sustain the correct mudra when you're sitting Zazen, the important, and I'm saying this, I don't know if Suzuki Roshi would say this, but the important factor is that you're holding a straight back, that you're aligned, you're not leaning from side to side, forward to backwards, you're just seated and steady and upright. And the lotus posture is the leg position that most forcefully sustains that straight back. And half lotus does it almost as well, but they're painful. Lotus and half lotus are very painful. And so if you can sit in a chair, and if you do, you should sit at the front edge of the chair and sustain your straight back, then that's fine to do. But it isn't that easy, actually, to sustain a straight back in a chair without moving. And Roshi emphasized that when you move, your mind moves, and that's it's counterproductive in Zazen to do something that creates movement of the mind. And Roshi would even, during Zazen occasionally, he would just shout out, you know, don't move, roaring through the Zendo because of that. So the answer to the question is, yes, it's fine to sit in a chair, but it's actually harder. So that's what I want to say about that. Are there other questions? I'm going to turn this here.
Thank you so much, Gail. This was so beautiful. And if there are any other questions, you all can talk also. You all can raise your hands or type messages. And we have one question, which is, I think, based on your last question. So it is said that in the Zazen posture, your mind and body have the great power to accept things as they are, whether agreeable or disagreeable. How do I put this into words in this age and time in my practical practice?
Okay, I have an answer for that, actually. And this comes from Reb Anderson again, who is a very senior, as I said, he's a Roshi today, but a very dedicated and he has a very heartfelt, compassionate practice. And what his advice about, well, his own experience about this that he writes about that I think answers this question is, he says that there's three kinds of pain. And the first kind of pain is what he knows from experience already is not harmful. So when he gets that pain and he recognizes it as one that is not harmful, he'll bear with it for a while. And then, but when he sees himself tensing up, he wants to always be gentle and kind and compassionate to himself as well as all beings. So he's not going to sit in Zazen in a painful posture without being compassionate to himself. But if he knows it's not harmful already, he will use that with discretion. And the second kind of pain is pain that he already knows is harmful. And so he will allow himself to soften that position in whatever way is necessary so that he doesn't injure himself. And even if it means stopping doing zazen right then. And the third way is he doesn't yet know if it's harmful or not harmful. And in that case, he assumes it's harmful until he finds out that it's not harmful, and he'll treat it just the way he would treat a pain that he already knows is harmful, which is that he'll be super kind and gentle and compassionate to himself and use discretion about where to go from there. And each and every circumstance is different, depending on your experience, what you know about your flexibility in your body, your level of pain tolerance. There's many, many, many considerations. But at all times, since Zen practice is about compassionate practice, our practice starts with ourselves. And you can't be being cruel to yourself and pretend like you're being compassionate to all beings. It just doesn't work. So you need to be gentle and kind and compassionate to yourself at all times if you plan to practice Zen. Are there other questions?
Yeah, that's such a beautiful point about self-compassion. There's also, I think, like a statement, like a question, and I think it is more about an example that you gave about a student. So the statement is, one does get a good dose of contradictions with this book, statements that seem to point in opposite directions at the same time. This is actually one of the elements I find so fascinating about this subject. The thing is, the only seem to point in opposite directions is also creating some contradictions, which are quite interesting. But is it the whole point of the book or the teachings?
You could say that, you almost could say that it is, in the sense that we human beings need to get that our minds are not the end of the story. In fact, our minds have tremendous limitations, and that the most important things to know, which are, we call it wisdom, which is different from knowledge, as I've said, cannot be grasped with the mind. So we have institutions like Harvard that are all about knowledge. And what can I say? I mean, the most important things cannot be grasped with the mind. So one way Suzuki Roshi had to trip people up was to be very he would say come very conflicting things. And as I said, he even went so far as to say, if things aren't paradoxical, they're not true, because everything and its opposite, given the two truths, that law of the two truths is a teaching from ancient India, that everything has both a conventional way of understanding and a ultimate way of understanding, and they're held simultaneously. And that's Roshi's justification for being so contradictory. I think he actually had fun with it. Yeah.
Absolutely. So there's another question. Is my challenge with the practice is that even though I do not want to start with any expectation, they somehow step in. And how do I deal with it?
Yes, they do step in. And the way to deal with it is to notice it. So there you are in Zazen, and there's arising fascinating thoughts, and you just simply notice there was an arising fascinating thought, and then you go back to whatever your practice is. And the point being that you're training yourself in non-grasping. So it doesn't actually matter how many thoughts you have in Zazen. What matters is your attachment to your thoughts. And it's said even that Buddha himself says about himself, I'm always thinking. And what is Buddha himself always thinking? Buddha himself is always thinking about, may all beings be happy. How can I support and sustain the well-being and peace of all beings? That's what Buddha is always thinking about, without stop. And so, and also Buddha is not grasping that. Buddha is thinking that, but not grasping that. And that, with that intention, sitting Zazen. And we have to do the same thing. One of the reasons we sit Zazen is that it's Buddha's posture, and we need to make ourselves like the Buddha. And this was the posture of the Buddha. So when we sit Zazen, we take on the posture of the Buddha, and within that, the alignment of the Buddha and even the mentality of the Buddha. And that's what it's all about. But we need to do it without grasping and without complimenting ourselves for, aren't we wonderful for doing this and all of that. It needs to be just pure. And like that quote I just read to you, when we start, it's a little rough, but as we practice, our practice becomes increasingly purified. And it's almost magical, actually, because you think of yourself as, what is this? You know, I'm not really doing anything. And it certainly doesn't feel like I'm doing anything, really. And it's sure painful. But little by little, you actually are doing something. And but again, you don't want to, it's not about a gaining idea. It's about just doing what you said you were going to do from the beginning. You make a vow, and then you fill your vow. And that is the whole meaning. It, like with the banjo, the meaning isn't to play the banjo. The meaning is to practice every day like I said I would. Okay.
Beautiful. Beautiful what you said about thinking and not grasping. There's another question. Can you tell us more about your journey and transitions in Zazen practice?
Well, yes. my journey is a little complex and unexpected. When I started, I heard about Zen, and I called Mel at the Berkeley Zendo, and I said, you know, what is this thing? And he said, well, just come. And so the next morning I went, you know, to attend 5 a.m. Zazen. And then I went back in the evening to attend 5:20 p.m. Zazen or whatever. And then I did that for the rest, for the next 11 years, with periods of time at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, which was extremely intense, especially for such a beginner. Probably today I would have never been allowed to go to Tassajara, but at the time I went to Tassajara after just 6 months of doing morning and evening Zazen. And of course, you can't even begin to be at Tassajara without sitting Tangaryo, which is not even periods of Zazen, but just all day of Zazen for 5 days. And so I really got thrown into it big time early on. And I also took the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony, those vows, and promptly forgot about them. And then fast forward 11 years, when I was not a very good student and community practice just didn't work for me, and I left. Not because I didn't believe in Buddhism or feel that that was the correct life for me, but it just didn't work for me to live in a community. And I developed a practice of poetry writing, which I did with the same spirit of just attend every single day, which I did for 40 years. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, the Bodhisattva vows that have been latent, kind of dormant in me for all these years, has suddenly exploded. And it seems like the only important thing for me to do is to focus on the practices that perfect embodying the Bodhisattva. So that's my journey. It's a very odd progression, extremely odd. Even I don't understand it. I wonder why someone asks even, but you don't have to answer.
Yeah, and I think we have like people who are like in different stages, maybe some people who are beginners, some people who are practicing this, but it's like a good mix of questions. The one question that we have is, I think you've answered the same question, and it is about the challenge also with the practice. So let me see. So it's written that, so there are some takeaways for me are about right attitude, repetition, and concentration. Can you say more about it, that if these three things are in place, can Zazen be practiced in a good way?
Well, I'm not sure I understand. If what teachings are in place?
So this person's saying, so for me, there are some takeaways from the practice. It's about right attitude, repetition, and concentration. So I think the question is that if they need to focus on these three, or maybe not having any expectations or like keeping it pure, what do you think?
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. Here's what I think. There are six critical, they're called perfections, paramitas, that we need to hold in our mind, and they happen in a progression. And the first one is generosity. And as I've already implied, generosity begins with being generous to yourself in the sense of what, you know, figuring out even what is being generous to yourself. I mean, allowing yourself to sit zazen is generous. It's, you're giving yourself the gift of zazen. And then when does the generosity turn into tension and pain that's beyond bearable? And after generosity, there's ethics and living a life according to ethical principles. And one practices generosity and kind of gets that down for yourself and moves on to practicing ethical principles and living according to those principles. And then this next one is patience. And these three are very important. They're like in the category of ordinary understanding. So there, we ground ourselves in what's doable, maybe not easy, but we need to have our roots in all three of those things before we actually can, you know, our body and minds are the same. So in order to sit upright, you can't be, you know, thinking about robbing a bank. I mean, it just doesn't go together. So there are these three practices: generosity, ethical principles, and patience that begin and ground. They ground and sustain upright sitting. And after that, you move into the next three, the last three. One is heroic effort, a very joyous, strong effort to be able to, and this is why I'm going into all of this, concentrate. That's the fifth one. Concentration requires all of the previous four to settle in deeply. Concentration, and with all of that, wisdom will simply arise. So the first five are like the groundwork for the wisdom mind to arise. And that's how it happens. It happens almost in that order. Although once you start practicing generosity and then you take on ethical principles, you don't give up generosity. You're still practicing generosity and ethical principles, and then and patience, and then and joyful effort, and then concentration. And frankly, concentration is my favorite of all of them. Concentration is so blissful. And I think there are even studies done on concentration is what makes people happy. So like, even if you're a bookkeeper, it takes concentration, and it's, people are very happy being bookkeepers for that reason. But again, this is not about attaching yourself to any of this. So you perfect them without attachment. And I know that was a kind of long answer, but I hope that helped.
Yeah, I think it was a very good answer, because so we have a last question, and I think it also answered that question, but you can explain more if you feel like. So the question is, how do I avoid pause in Zen practice? So I think you've spoken about it a lot, But if you want to say any more words.
To avoid what?
The question is, how do I avoid thoughts? And we have another question also.
Okay, well, I have. Yeah. I mean, I have in two ways. One, I said that the Buddha himself said, I'm always thinking. So you don't need to avoid thoughts, actually. That's number one. That's point one. And point two is that even though you're having thoughts, you don't need to grasp onto your thoughts. So I know a huge mistake that I made as a beginning Zazen practitioner was I actually was in so much pain that I welcomed my thoughts and would almost like entertain, you know, well, I'm going to think about this today during Zazen so that, you know, the time passes quickly and I can distract myself from the pain, which is, of course, exactly the opposite of what you're supposed to do. But the Buddha would say, it's fine to have thoughts, but you don't do the second part. You don't plan to have your thought and then grasp onto it and organize your whole Zazen period around it and then go, oh, great, now I solved that problem and I can go home. It's a very successful Zazen practice today. So that's not how to do it. Maybe that makes it clearer how to do it if you understand what not to do. So thoughts are fine. Getting attached to your thoughts is not fine. It's really that simple. And you have the Buddha as your perfect example, who says, I'm always thinking. But don't forget what Buddha was thinking. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free. May all beings have peace.
Yeah. Perfect. So we have another question now, and this is probably the last one. The preface to the book states that English is thoroughly dualistic in its assumptions, unlike Japanese. It is hard to understand how any language can be that restricting. Can you comment?
Yes. I devoted my life to this question, actually, which it's why it was the whole motivation to my poetry practice. There are some languages, believe it or not, Tibetan is one, and I'm sure Sanskrit is one, that use language to go beyond language. And I feel that my 40 years of writing poetry was to have English be included in that list. And so I think it's possible to use English to go beyond English, but it's very difficult and it's unfortunate. And so there is this issue of our mind is pretty trapped in dualism. That is just true. What we can understand with conventional truth is dualistic. Conventional truth is dualistic. Ultimate truth is non-dualistic. That's why it can't be understood with our minds, and we can't understand ultimate truth. So it's ungraspable. And the best we can do is to prepare our body and mind to open to it at some point. That's all. That's the best we can do. But these six practices that I just kind of elaborated on a minute ago is the way. Those are the practices that help us do that. I think, let's see, there's a tiny bit more time. If there are more questions, otherwise we can just stop.
Okay. Anybody can ask the question live also, if they're not too shy. Otherwise, thank you so much, Gail, for explaining each and every question in such detail. And I think, yeah, I think it'll be a good idea. You can wind up with your last words.
Okay.
Oh, wait a second. Sorry, we have another one. Okay, we have another one. When sitting and trying to practice beginner's mind, I can clear myself of thoughts sometimes and can feel myself in the moment, and this feels good. Other times, I can clear myself of thoughts and feel nothing, just blank, and this does not feel good or bad. I prefer the former, but is the latter one the goal of the beginner's mind?
Okay. So, number one, there's no goal, right? Well, this is an activity that's non-gaming, and no goal setting. And this is why it's so ironic that Suzuki Roshi adored Americans, because he thought that their minds were so receptive to Zen. But he forgot that Americans are the most goal-oriented of all humans. I mean, you know, you can't work for a corporation without, you know, vowing to earn 25% more next year. And if you don't, you know, you're out of here. Sort of, we have a pretty gaining community here in America. So Zazen is a practice of non-gaming. And then, let's see, say the question again. Read the question again.
When sitting and trying to practice beginner's mind, I can clear myself of thoughts sometimes and can feel myself in the moment, and this feels good. Other times, I can clear myself of thoughts and feel nothing,
yes.
Just blank.
Yes.
And this does not feel good or bad.
Yes.
I prefer the former, but is the latter one the goal of the beginner's mind?
Okay, well, there's no goal of beginner's mind, first of all. But the latter, maybe you could say it's an acquired taste. I think the more you're able to sit without grasping, to just notice your thoughts, do not grasp them, do not entertain them, and there's just a kind of blankness there. See if you can enter the blankness with greater depth. And you may actually, the point is not to enjoy, You're not there to enjoy anything, or not to enjoy. You're just there to do the practice. It's not about enjoy or not enjoy. However, you may find a richness in that blankness if you're able to relax more in your body and mind and feel the depth that's actually there in the blankness. You may find that at least it won't push you away. Like Zazen can feel so harsh if you're not kind to yourself, that it can push you away. Initially, the first students at Tassajara, when I was there, they would not allow themselves not to sit full lotus and all of that, and many of them, because they never developed a compassionate practice, ended up, you know, Zen is too hard, and they left. And it's really a shame. Yeah. So you have to, and there's no formula. Each person has to kind of arrive at the correct way, not only for themselves, but each and every Zazen period. You don't get this down pat, you know, because sure enough, the next time it's not going to be that way. No matter how it is, it's not going to be that way the next time. This is not something that you get down pat. It is something that's cumulatively marvelous, I will say. Cumulatively marvelous. And maybe I shouldn't be saying that, but it's just true. Maybe that's a good note to stop on.
Yeah, this was the last question. And no, we have one more, sorry. Just got another one. Can you speak on the idea of judgment, judging self, situations, others, etc., with regard to beginner's mind? It does not feel compatible within the realm of beginner's mind. Where is judgment coming from? Is this different from perception?
Yes. Well, the answer that I have for that question is a big answer as opposed to a small answer. And it may not be something you understand right away, but one of the basic truths of Buddhism is that we are not separate from all beings. Some call this idea that we're separate individuals the great human disaster, that we still think of ourselves as separate as opposed to one whole, like one whole taste, one whole body. And that we, each and every one of us, sustain all beings, and all beings sustain us, and all of that happens at the same time. So when you have a judging mind, that comes from an ego, a place of an ego, which is a place of separateness from others. And so it's fundamentally not only untrue, it's inaccurate, but it can give you the feedback of, I'm still there, I'm still coming from that separate place where the practices of Zazen, just by the way, works away at that. And even when you're in that blank space that someone mentioned a minute ago of you're neither here nor there, you're just kind of in this blank zone, that's a movement toward oneness as opposed to separateness. So that's why when I said that it may not feel great right now, but if you can get into the depth of it, it may feel better, because intrinsically it is better. Intrinsically, it's a step toward universality, non-duality, community, however you want to call it. And so use judgment. When you see yourself having a judgment about anything, just allow it to be feedback to yourself about that. Oh, look, see, there's my judging mind again. Thought I was over this.
Perfect. Now we have last 2 minutes, Gail, I think, and we don't have any more questions.
Well, it was such a pleasure to be with you. I'm so happy that you attended, all of you. It's thrilling for me. And we'll be meeting weekly for 10 weeks. And I think you need to sign in each time. So with that, we can just end then.